Well, this morning we're going to continue to branch off in the little kind of mini-series of messages that have such a practical emphasis to them, but yet such an important one connected with who we are and what we're called to do and all of our relationships in life. And I'm going to be referring to Matthew 28, if you'd like to turn to that as well. I'll have it up here on the screen then. And one of the most encouraging things for me is to be hearing the kinds of ways people are applying what they're listening to. And it seems that everyone's finding opportunities to make application. If you're not, wake up. pay attention. And I shared before that some of the practical things we're talking about are especially helpful for younger people. And some of us older people could listen to this and think, wow, if I knew that 30 years ago, what a difference that could have made in numbers of contexts of life. And so this is a really practical emphasis, but it's going to have a deep connection to our calling as God's people and the followers of Christ. And so what we've been looking at is just trying to, in a practical way, match different leadership styles or ways of relating and communicating. It could be communication styles to the situations and individual needs of others. And we have three that we've been talking about: the directive style, consultative style, and free range style. And, you know, each of us probably has a dominant one. That is our default. We have it, no doubt, in connection with personality and temperament, maybe a little genetics thrown in, or just the way it was modeled in front of us in our home of origin. And so we tend to shift to a dominant one, but maturity comes when you're able to move between them freely in the most effective way based on the situations and the individual needs. Maturity comes when you're able to restrain the tendency you would normally go to when a circumstance or situation calls for the other one. And life will do it to you. Life will bring that to you. How many of you have adult children? I do. How many of you have adult married children? Yeah. Well, one of the things you're going to find is that you better think through how you're going to approach them. Do you think directive is the right approach to them? Probably not. That'll tend to backfire. Right? And, so usually consultative or free rein, but if you're overly directive, they'll probably never look to you for consultation. We have to think through how do we relate to them. That's why at a wedding, I always have that reaffirmation of family ties when we call parents up and I thank them for their years of love and sacrifice that have brought the couple to the day. And then I give them that little piece of advice. Some of you have heard it enough that you could repeat it. And that is, I tell them, be available, but don't be overly involved. Be available, but don't be overly involved. Because that kind of thing can really make it difficult. So the question that I think we need to go to is, what am I trying to accomplish? What are the results I'm looking for? And is the method I'm using getting me to those results or working against me? Sometimes our motives can be good, but our method or our approach is not good. We kind of want to have good outcomes, but we're using wrong methods to get to those outcomes. And so part of growing and maturing is trying to understand the person, the need, the situation, and then making the adjustment with reference to that. And what I'd like to do in kind of a larger context for us is just for a moment connect it to three things: the mission of Christ followers, the model of Christ ministry, and the mind of Christ in us. I'll come to the mind of Christ a little bit later, but at least connect this to the mission of Christ followers. You know, when I've had conversations with Pastor Todd about these things, he kept connecting this to the Great Commission, which is what I asked you to turn to in Matthew 28, 18 through 20. And I just was having a hard time really making the connection, but it kind of clicked on me that if you don't understand and get these things down, you're probably not going to be as effective. And frankly, you could be counterproductive in fulfilling the mission that we're called to fulfill. And Christ gave his disciples that final mission. We'll see it in the model of Christ's ministry. He took the time to teach them, to mentor for them, to kind of walk with them as they go through it. And then he just commissioned them. And the commission comes in these words that Jesus came to his disciples and he said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." By the way, I always like to pause and say, who says that kind of stuff? Really? I mean, honestly, who says all authority? Either an absolute nutcase, right? Don't patronize Jesus. Said he, well, he was a good man. He was a moral leader. He was a good teacher. You know, don't patronize the kind of stuff he said. Don't patronize Christ like that. He either is who he said he was in so many different ways, or he's just flat out crazy, or he's a liar, or he's a, you know, some sort of a false kind of prophet or something. Jesus made so many statements like this. All authority, that's a lot of territory. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. On the basis of this, go and make disciples of all nations. This is their commission. It's our commission too. You say, how do you know that? Well, because he told them to baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Then he said, teach them to obey everything I've commanded you. So follow the logic. If they're going out and making disciples, they're teaching them to obey everything Christ commanded them, and Christ commanded them to go and make disciples, then they're teaching them to do that. So every new disciple owns this mission. Every new follower of Christ owns this mission. You're probably aware that the command in the context in the Greek language is not go, although it's translated this way. It's as you go, the command is make disciples. Gather a group of learners. Did Christ do it? Did he model it? Of course he did. He had a group of learners, and what a group it was. I can't tell you how many times he must have looked to heaven and said, are you sure you chose these people for me before the foundation of the world to be my followers? I mean, this motley crew, this tough crew, you know, if you get frustrated about the Sunday school class you lead or small group you lead, then, you know, take it easy, because it's probably nothing like this group who argued about who was greatest among them, and just, you know, it was interesting. I'm sure he shook his head a few times. But, you know, you make disciples, you're learners, you're involved in influencing other people's lives and coming alongside of and calling people to this kind of a relationship with yourself. And when you're involved in that kind of relationship, you need to ask the question, you know, what is the best approach? Because it's not going to be the same with everyone. Each one can be different, and you might have to choose a very directive approach with one, but the other one, maybe a consultative approach. You need to think through what kind of results am I looking for? What is the best approach to take with regard to them? Usually these kinds of settings start out with a higher level of a directive, and they move to consultative because they're not ready to be consulted because they haven't been taught. So in the model of Christ's ministry, and they shouldn't all be ones, but, you know, they are because they're all important, you know, Jesus told them what and why. He taught them. He showed them how. He mentored for them, right? And then he gave them responsibilities. He evaluated them along the way. And he often used questions. Jesus used questions all the time in the way he taught. And that engages a person. That invites them in. A question can be one of the most effective tools, depending on how it's toned. You know, you can ask a question in a tone that's very directive. Or you can ask a question in a tone that's condemning. But if you ask a question in a tone that's inviting, that's a different kind of a thing. Then he sent them out to fulfill the mission. He gave them that responsibility to go forward and do this. And he set the example for us in making disciples. We're called to make disciples. But that requires us to engage people in context where we have to talk to them about things that have to do with faith and so forth. And what we'll find is that in the various types of approaches to people, the directive approach, consultative approach, free reign approach, that we generally have produced a culture now that is largely not interested in a directive approach. I mean, when it comes to faith, when it comes to talking about faith, because there's this kind of attitude out there that says faith is a personal matter, and it really should not be something that is in any way pushed at anybody else, or should not be something that we try to imply that you need to believe what I believe, or you need to, you know, think about God the way I think about God. We've kind of taken it out of the realm of objective, factual truth, and we've put it into the realm of personal kind of feeling and opinion that makes you feel good about yourself and makes your day a little bit better, that kind of a thing. And so, you know, and it's certainly something that should not be pushed on anybody else, because that's rather rude and intrusive to imply somehow that you should think about God the way I think about God. Instead, what we should do is celebrate each individual's choices with regard to whatever religion they affirm, and if it helps them and it's, you know, makes their day better, then, you know, be happy for them and leave it at that. That's how we kind of have taken and all of faith and religion, we've made it that. And the problem with that is that, you know, if we were talking about whether or not you like chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream, that's fine. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about things that matter profoundly. And so we have to resist the temptation to be marginalized in the culture, to somehow be muted and silenced, and sometimes to tiptoe. You know, the Bible talks a lot about Christians being persecuted, but you know, we probably won't get near persecuted because we won't offend anybody in any way at all. We're so careful not to say anything that rattles anybody or upsets somebody. And yet we recognize that truth has that power to it and an ability to it. I think it is important to recognize that some people will reject you not for what you say but for how you say it. But some people will reject you no matter how you say it. And that's a reality. No matter how gentle you are, how careful you are. But we've really, in our culture, taken faith and relegated it to this kind of personalized, like vanilla chocolate kind of thing, and put it in that category, and it has made it challenging. We've mandated that there are certain settings, like work settings and so forth, where you have to really be careful about what you say. The Bible, which was once read in schools, dare not be mentioned almost, you know, or we'll be in real trouble. And so what have we done? You know, what have we done? And, you know, the truth is that... not to offend those who work at universities, but our universities have fostered this kind of spirit and put this challenge out there so that if somebody finds out that you believe in the Bible, you believe in God, you believe in Jesus, they'll say, really? Like, you're one of those? Really? Really? You take that stuff seriously? Really? Really? It's almost like you... But see, and sometimes they think they're really smart for saying that stuff, but really they've just been conditioned to say it. You've just been kind of, you're just kind of going with the flow of the culture when you say it. You're not really, don't pretend you're really smart to say it, because I'll test you and find out if you're really smart to say that. And then we'll see how smart you really are. You know, you go with the flow and what everybody else is saying. So we have to recognize, however, that in light of this, that sometimes we do need to be very wise. What that verse, Colossians 4:5, be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Making the most of every opportunity, let your conversation be full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you might know how to answer everyone. And that means that there is probably the likelihood that you're going to need more of a consultative approach when you're trying to invite people into a conversation about what they believe. Not that you can never go toward the directive, but in our culture, in each culture, you have to look at what is the most effective approach to lead people into a conclusion or a conversation and a conclusion about things that matter very, very much. And some of us need to hear this, because some of us, especially we who are directive, I say we, you know me too, we who are directive probably need to hear this a lot, because it takes incredible restraint to not shift into your mode. And not, you know, when I'm in a situation that probably is more consultative and that would be the best effective way to go, I need to exercise more restraint not to become directive. And, you know, please understand, I'm not talking about things that are right and wrong. Like, I'm not interested in having a consultation on whether or not we want to throw rocks at the neighbor's windows or something. And I don't want a consultation about that. I know what that answer is. I know where we go with that one, right? No need for a discussion. End of the discussion's over. We don't do it. Okay, but when it's not so much a matter of right or wrong, but a matter of wise or best, well, in those categories, now we need to, you know, have this conversation. But even in the context of witness and engaging people with about faith, you know, I can ask a question like, do you think there is a God? Now, I could say, well, that's a dumb question. Of course there's a God. I should just be directive and say, there's a God. Well, no, but it depends on who I'm talking to. You know, it depends on what I'm trying to accomplish. I can have a conversation that leads toward conclusions that I might hold very strongly, but be careful not to announce them and pronounce them so strongly when my dominant tendency, my natural tendency, is to go after them. And this is really important for some of us to hear, isn't it? Especially if we are given toward the directive. Because as we'll see in a bit, you know, what happens is sometimes we push people away. We alienate people. We engage in conversation stoppers, not conversation openers, right? It's like, you know, saying something like, the New England Patriots don't have a chance to win today. They're a horrible team. Okay. Can we have a conversation about that? Or is that, you know, are the facts backing that up? Or is that what you hope for? Yes. That's my answer, by the way. I do hope for. I do. I lived in Georgia for a little while, so, and my wife grew up 15 minutes from the Pat Stadium, so I hate them. But you can delete that from the recording. But the family all just are diehard season ticket holders up there, and I'll never forgive what they did to my Eagles, and, you know. But nevertheless, you make a statement like that, and it doesn't really invite anybody into any kind of conversation. It's kind of like what we call a conversation stopper. And we have to be careful with that if we are the directive type, that we be careful how we communicate and the way we say things. Because, and we'll look at that a little bit more closely in a moment, but the consultative people have to be careful as well, because there are circumstances that call for directive, and you're not giving them. Parenting is largely a directive enterprise when they're young. And if you're doing consultative when they're young, too much consultative, it actually does not produce a secure environment for kids to grow up in. Do you know that? Kids need a directive environment when they're younger like that. And then you gradually draw them into the consultative, you know, but you're not really helping them much if you don't give them directive when they need directive, right? And that's important. So these contexts are just so valuable for us to understand, and I hope you'll challenge yourself if you know that you have a tendency. You say, well, that's just the way I am, you know, my dad was like that. He always spoke his mind, and I thought that's a good characteristic. Speak your mind. Well, it is sometimes, but it really isn't sometimes too, you know. Don't default just because it's the way you are, or people don't like it, too bad, you know. That's a real missional kind of statement, isn't it? You know, you'll be a good disciple maker if you have that attitude. We have to really be willing to challenge ourselves and go up against both temperament, personality, upbringing, inherited traits, and all of those things. And I think they all fall into the category of spiritual transformation, where God is transforming us so that the mind of Christ, we'll look at that in a moment, the mind of Christ controls how the mission is fulfilled and the model for fulfilling that mission. So we looked at some scriptures, Colossians 4, 5, and 6. We looked at Romans 12, 10, love each other with genuine affection. Take delight, or be the first in honoring each other. Outdo each other. Go out of the way and be the first to honor each other is kind of the meaning of the language. So we want to let these verses shape our way of relating. We looked at them last week. And then the really encouraging area is the three words that we've been using that are words that have helped a lot of people. And that is pause, identify, and adjust. Pause, identify, and adjust. Now, look, the pause thing is probably more important for directive people, because they have the, you see that gun up there that has a, you know, has a lock on the trigger, you know, so the idea is that, you know, be careful if you have a hair trigger, you know, a trigger that goes off very easily, so that, and it's usually from here to here, right? And it goes off like that. And look, it's not just directive people. Consultative people can do this as well. All you need to do is veer into an area where they feel like they've got a lot of expertise and knowledge. If you veer into their area, boom, here we go. They're directive all of a sudden, and they're talking because you've now hit the area where they know the most about. And so it's not just directive people, but directive people especially have to be willing to hit that pause button and hold back. And then identify the results you want, and then, you know, make the adjustment that you need to make. And so I would challenge you to recognize those situations when the pause is needed. Now, if you have difficulty recognizing them, here's a little recommendation. You know, change is usually not something that happens alone. It usually happens by the aid of others. You don't go bad places alone. You're usually running with people. You don't go good places alone. You need people around you, right? He who walks with the wise becomes wise. The companion of fools comes to ruin. So you need the aid of others, especially if you're trying to change a deeply entrenched characteristic that has a family history. And so what I invite you to do is have a significant other person in your life. And if it's your husband or wife, they're sometimes the most ideal. And then when you start going off in your mode, encourage them to be the instrument of change by asking them to give you a look. Like, are you going to do that? Are we doing that again? Are we going there again? Some kind of look. Now, don't be too condemning with the look. You know, use a look that's non-directive, that's more consultative or free reign. And just invite them to respond. And listen, if you've invited your mate to do that, don't ever say, what are you looking at me that way for? That's a sure loser right there, you know. Instead, just say, At that point, they've done their duty. You've invited them. You've asked them to remind me through a look. Okay, their duty's done. At that point, you take over. You say, I'm doing it again, aren't I? Yeah, you are. Ah, I got to change that. I got to be careful about that. You see, if you don't have built-in reminders, if you don't have somebody come along and remind you of that, it's just so easy to go to your natural default and just kind of not be aware. Sometimes we're not aware, especially men, we're not aware. I mean, and we've, those little things are helpful reminders to us. And so that's a little recommendation I give you so that you can pause. It takes self-discipline to pause and to not click into your normal, natural mode. You know, I use as an illustration, Todd and Steph, who are here today and are going to be terribly embarrassed when I use the illustration, but they terribly embarrassed me. Well, she did. And Todd, you don't deserve this, but she does. And in public, in front of everybody, when they told the story about one of their adjustments, I was overseeing a panel discussion of newly married people who were talking about the adjustments they made in marriage. And one of the couples we invited was my daughter and son-in-law. And I was the moderator, and she said, one of the adjustments I made has to do with my father and my husband, and that is that, you know, my father was always someone who I could ask a question, and he'd give a quick answer. He'd analyze, and my husband likes to be a little bit more deliberate and make better decisions, probably, think through things, right? And so I would go and ask him a question, and, you know, he would think about it for a moment. But what he didn't know is I already asked my father, and my father had the answer already. So I said, well, when he'd pause enough of a pause, and it's like, okay, well, I asked my father, and he said, uh-oh, you start that road. And one of the horrible things was that she was telling this story in front of everyone, and I'd never heard it before. I'm like, what? Somebody let me in on this? What's going on here, right? And my son-in-law, good man that he is, said, Steph, you know, I really respect your dad, and appreciate what he has to say, but could you come to me first before you go to him? That makes sense, doesn't it? Sure. But I'm sitting here going, what? I was the victim of this circumstance. I didn't know I was being played into the scenario like this. So I've had to learn when she still comes to dad and asks him things to say, have you asked your husband yet? If you haven't, don't talk to me, right? Because we want to see what he has to say. I haven't followed that, you know, completely 100% faithfully because I default into my normal directive kind of mode. And that's an example of how you have to, you know, decide that that's not the way I'm going to do it. I'm not going to go into that mode. And so these are three important words. We pause, we identify the desired results. What do I want to see accomplished here? As I said, sometimes you're frustrated because of the results, but you're causing the results by the way you're approaching the situation. And then we adjust. These little pictures are compliments of Dennis Milan. He likes visuals. So he supplied some visuals for me. And I think this one fits him, especially a wrench, you know. And so, and that's an adjustable wrench too. So adjust your response to produce the appropriate leadership style, right? And it's a sign of maturity the more you're able to do this. And listen, you'll be more effective in all relationships, whether family, business, marriage, all relationships, out, mission, evangelism, witness. You'll be more effective in all relationships if you can learn to do this, really. It's that important. But it takes self-control. So don't be like the city whose walls are broken down, but exercise and live out the fruit of the Spirit, which, among other things, is self-control. And I think one of the defining factors for this in our spiritual context is the mind of Christ. And let me just say this quickly, and that is that a lot of times the reason we're not pausing, identifying, adjusting is because we're only thinking of ourselves. We're just thinking of what we want to say, how we feel, how we want to respond, and not really thinking about the other person. The mind of Christ is meant to shape us in a posture of humility toward other people, where we look with honor on them and we treat their interest as important. And we don't do things out of selfish ambition, but in all of our relationships, we have the mind of Christ, who set aside his greatness and glory. And, you know, as it goes on in Philippians 2, it says, he did not regard his equality with God as something to leverage in every moment to use to his own advantage, although he could have done it very easily. And he reminded Pilate on one occasion when Pilate says, don't you understand I have the authority both to crucify you or to release you? Jesus said, you don't get it, do you? It's not about power. This is not about authority. You would have no authority over me unless it was given you from above. And by the way, get a clue, because at this moment, he didn't say get a clue, but at this moment, I could call upon my Father and he would dispense at my side so many angels that it would be over quickly. This is not about power. So Christ did not leverage, it says, take advantage of his equality with God. And that takes restraint. You know, when you're in a situation where I could be directive because I have the authority to be directive, I could. That takes tremendous restraint to stop and say, look, I'm not going to exercise that authority in this situation because I don't think it's the most effective means of getting people into owning the conclusion and reaching the conclusion and living it out. All right, that was just a quick bit of overview with a larger context for it now. In the remaining moments, we're going to quickly just be reminded of a few things. The directive, we're going to look a little bit more closely. We did this review. Directive, authoritative is the leader-centered giving orders and directions. By the way, I want to encourage you as husbands and wives and as parents to kind of be open and honest in your conversations with one another about what you think your tendency is and how you think your tendencies work together or don't work well together. You know, and really be willing to look at yourself and, you know, and be first. You know, here's a principle. If you want to really have these kind of conversations and make them effective, then it's going to be built off of Matthew 7:1-5, where Jesus said, you better not be running around splinter checking somebody else's eye when you got a log hanging out of your own eye. Judge yourself first, he said. Then you'll be able to see clearly to judge someone else. So start with self-judgment before you get involved in looking at somebody else's problems or faults. You know, deal with yourself first, Matthew 7:1-5. So we have this directive or authoritative approach, leader-centered giving orders. The aim of this approach is really obedience. And in circumstances where obedience is the right outcome, you can just use the directive approach or circumstances that call for it. I used the head coach to, context last week, and that's certainly a more directive role and one that necessitates it. The advantages of this role are that it leads to quick decision-making. It helps in crisis situations where there's immaturity, where right answers are needed. It addresses the problem of indecisiveness. Maybe you're in a situation where a group of people need an answer and nobody's stepping up. Then you might need to just step up and say, look, we need to be decisive about this. And it often can yield better results when decisions are necessary. But there are disadvantages. Real quickly, there are disadvantages to this. And that is it centers in a person, the leader. And it sometimes can create an unhealthy dependence upon that person, being the directive person. It doesn't encourage others to use their creativity, take initiative. It doesn't draw upon the strengths of others. It doesn't multiply through others. If it's so dominant and so overarching that it doesn't really engage others and utilize their gifts and abilities, and it kind of isolates a leader, and he doesn't really work with and through other people. But there's another problem with it too, and that is it could drive people away from you or cause them to calculate around you. You ever go to someone else's house or you're traveling, going somewhere, and you say, now look, before we get there, just remember, don't bring up politics because you know where that's going to go, you know. Or you go to the house, don't bring up sports or don't bring up this because, you know, if you bring that up, we're going to hear about it for an hour. I just don't want to have to go through that, right? So you go there and you calculate. There are certain things we're not going to talk about. And look, here's the thing is, if I'm a kind of person where people are calculating with me, then I need to ask whether or not I really have the mind of Christ. Because get me on my subject. Oh, here I go. Everybody's going to be held hostage for 1 hour on my subject. You know, we have to be careful about that. Pull back and watch around you. Be sensitive to what's happening in other people's lives and aware of where other people are at. That's important. And especially if it's our area of strength or interest, we have to be careful about that kind of thing and not drive people away from us or cause them to calculate around us. And by the way, mentioning parents of adult children or married adult children, sometimes what happens is we panic and we feel like, oh no, I know why she's relating to her husband that way because I gave her a bad example. And then we do the guilt, regret kind of thing and we start trying to go repair it. It's not time for repair. You be careful. Go in. Now I'm going to tell you not to. You can have a conversation and say, look, I know why you struggle with this because mom didn't set a good example for you or dad didn't set a good example for you. You can have that kind of conversation. But if you go in and start trying to fix it and manage it and direct it, they're just going to be careful about how much time they spend around you. And they're going to set boundaries in place. And, you know, it's just not going to work, and you're going to lose all the influence and all the opportunity to be available as a consultant to them that could be there for you. So you have to really be careful about that kind of thing, especially in those kinds of relationships. And again, it's not motive. Sometimes you mean well. You really mean well, but we do it in the wrong way. And, you know, that can relate to gifts. I remember a couple one time, you know, telling me in premarital counseling that they were so excited because they built a house right behind her parent, right behind his parents' house in the same development. I said, "You did? Oh, okay." They were kind of taken back that I wasn't excited about that. I said, how do you think that's going to go? They're going to be really close, you know. And she made this expression like, "I'm already finding out how it's going to go, you know. Why? Because Mom found these curtains for my bathroom at a yard sale, and she thinks they'd match wonderfully. Uh-oh. What if you don't put those curtains in the bathroom? What if she comes in and she says, 'I've never seen those curtains I got you in the bathroom.' Oh. Or what if she comes to your yard sale and finds out they're on the table again? Uh-oh. Ooh. See, Mom means well. She means well, but she's using a faulty method that's going to potentially cause problems. You see, you might mean well. Your motive might be right. But your method and your approach needs to be called into check. And it doesn't mean, you know, my wife bought some towels for our daughter-in-law for her bathroom, and they were perfect, weren't they? I mean, perfect. My wife showed, she said, "Oh, I got them towels." I said, "Oh, okay, can I see them, you know?" I saw them. I said, "Oh, they're perfect. They're her. That's her. That's her." But my wife did the right thing. She gave them with qualifiers. She gave them and said, you know, "Hey, look, if you don't like these, they don't have to be there. That's fine. You know, don't worry about that at all." And, you know, and you have to mean that. Because if a year later you say, "I never did see those curtains," you know, that's going to be a problem, you know. And these are examples of how we mean well, but we just do not use the right approach and the right method. We're not being wise. That's what's happening. We're not being wise. So quickly, we only have a few, not long, the consultative or democratic style. Some of you say, "That's me. That's my approach. I'm a very consultative kind of person. My immediate default position when something comes up is to kind of have a conversation and collect the views and hear what different people have to say. And that's kind of my approach." And you know, and that's your natural default. So directive people like me make you bristle, you know. Like, "Oh, he just made a directive statement. We need to have, could I ask three questions about that?" I had a, you know, a very close friend of mine, Dr. Michael Murray, was philosophy, chairman of the philosophy department at Franklin Marshall College. And Michael and I have been good friends for many years. And Michael's a philosopher. And philosophers blink a lot. And they ask a lot of questions. And they, you know, and especially when you make very definitive statements to them. I used to do it just for fun. I'd want to see his eyes blink. I'd make a definitive statement. And he kind of, you know, Okay. But, I mean, if that's this, then maybe that's that. And, you know, if that's that, then this could be this. And, you know, it's like, okay, it's going to be an hour before we get anywhere. But, you know, I think it was partly how his brain was wired. And that's probably why we got along so well. Because he said, even though it makes him blink a lot, he said it's refreshing to hear somebody speak definitively. He said, "I find it refreshing. To hear that, unless you're really just wrong." So the consultative approach is good in that it decentralizes leadership. It delegates decisions and authority. It shares them. And in that situation, a leader might choose to make a final decision. He might choose to set the boundaries for the consultation and boundaries for the conversation. And that's within reason. But at the same time, It's engaging others and valuing their contributions and their input and seeing what they can give. So the advantages are that it recognizes value in others. It encourages positive attitudes and it reduces resistance to change because you're involving people in it. If you just bring about the change and you don't involve people in it, then that's problematic. You know, that's going to cause it to have, especially in a democratic culture like ours. You know, where people are used to having a participation and a say in things. Let me give you an illustration. When we moved to this facility here, we didn't have to have any congregational approval because, you see, the way our church is set up is it's set up like this. The board cannot incur the congregation into purchased indebtedness above 2 months' average annual income without congregational approval. And that's a safeguard, right? We're not allowed to run out and put the congregation into some massive debt and just say, God told us. You have any questions? Why should you? God told us, right? Who are you? We're not allowed to do that, see? But when we purchased this facility, it didn't involve purchasing indebtedness because we had the money. So we had the authority then to make the decision. But if we made the decision without any communication, you know, we opened the facility up and brought people over to look at it, answered questions. We engaged people. We didn't really have to do any of that. We could have just done a very directive decision because we have the right and authority within the Constitution to make this decision. But what happens is in our culture, you know, people, and it's rightly so, it's going to affect people. So get them involved. Let them be part of, let them ask questions and be part of it. But you have to be smart in how you do that because some churches are very foolish about that kind of thing. I use the illustration of the church that, you know, my friend who pastors a large church and they were putting in a new sound system, which, you know, is anywhere from $50,000 to $250,000 to $300,000. Right? A 50 would be probably just replacing speakers or something. But, you know, the reality is that it's a very complicated and very expensive, and the equipment is just very technical. And he had to have a congregational meeting and had to have a vote on the sound system. I said, uh-oh, that's not good. Because not everybody is an expert in sound. Some people think you just run down Radio Shack, grab two speakers, a mic, and throw it in and have at it. Right? They don't realize what could be involved. I mean, many, many years ago, we spent $50,000 on our first sound system for this facility. And, you know, all of a sudden what happens is you're sharing ownership of the decision with people who don't have the knowledge to be able to understand it and discuss it, and you're creating problems. You're creating problems where you don't need the problems. You know, when you have decisions to make, buy a car, or buy a house, you're going to go to the people in the know. You're going to go to the people who you believe have the kind of information and expertise to help you. You're not going to go to everybody and just ask everybody the question. And so we do have to be wise in the way we fulfill that. And that's part of the disadvantages of consultative, is that it's something that can create problems if it's not used wisely. By the way, it's also, I have the second point, is time-consuming and slower, and that's really hard for directive people because they want to get to the point, right? Directive people really need to restrain, hold back. And so it requires more maturity from leaders and participants, doesn't it, to be in a consultative environment because it can open the door to an antagonist. You can have one person in a group who's going to be antagonistic, and they're going to cause problems. And every time you bring up a question, you think, oh, no, I wonder what he'll do with that. I wonder where he'll take that. And everybody's like, oh, because this antagonistic person has just been invited to speak. And, you know, one of the things that I think I should say about this as well is that a consultative leader would tend to deal with a situation like that by dealing with it as a group. Like, say you have one person is very antagonistic in a group. Consultative leader wants to say, okay, so I was thinking what we all should be considering here is how we're talking to each other. And what he'll do is he will publicly correct the antagonist by applying it to everyone. And everyone sits there saying, well, we know who this is about. Why doesn't he just tell him? I mean, I don't think, are we doing that? I don't think we're doing that. You know? And what happens is, it happens in schools too. You have one kid who's disrupting the class. And, you know, the whole educational process is held hostage so that we can figure out how to make Johnny fit in among us. Well, maybe what we do is make Johnny sit outside for a while. See how he likes that. And maybe he'll come back in and be a compliant participant who is reasonable and respectful. So, you know, be careful not to utilize that a tendency to want to kind of make it everybody's issue and everybody. Just pull the guy outside, pull him aside and be directive with him and, you know, and engage that person one-on-one. It's an absence of leadership sometimes that creates this sense of, oh, I wish somebody would just step up and do something or make a decision here. The final one, and I only have 2 minutes to talk about it, is free reign. You see that horse up there? Yeah. When Todd and I were talking about it, he says, a great illustration of this is horseback riding, and you probably have no experience with that at all. I said, hold up, fella. I owned a horse. I actually owned a horse one time. That's right. I've shoveled manure, so much of it out of the barn, because if I was going to own a horse, my dad said, you're going to have to clean the barn. So and it was kind of a large pony. I mean, but I was little. It was a horse to me. It really was. It was a big pony. It really was. And Then I was a participant in Boys Brigade. Somebody came up to me after early service and said, I don't even know anybody's ever heard of Boys Brigade. How many of you heard of Boys Brigade? Boys, you know, Pioneer Girls and Boys Brigade. Some of us really know about that, right? Sure, sure. And I was in Boys Brigade. I went to the camp where, you know, we rode horses and rode them at full throttle. And I had all those experiences in camp. Even though I'm a city boy, generally I had these experiences. And they were, so I know what it's like. Listen, when you're riding a horse at full throttle, are you holding those reins tight? No. You get there loose. Is the horse aware that they're there? And that the bit is in the mouth? Yeah, he's still aware. Because if you need it, you can pull them back. You can take control and slow it down and turn the horse and, you know. And so the free rein leadership is an effort to let loose on the reins, give freedom to others and decision making to others. It's not so much consultative in the sense that you're more available as a contact if needed, but you're turning it over to the group or individual and allowing them to be able to make the decisions and essentially giving them the authority. But you can exercise free rein leadership with still having somewhat of a hold on the reins if necessary and pulling them back. You know, in parenting, you can be directive, or as the children are getting older, you can be consultative, because sooner or later, if you don't move from control to influence, you'll lose influence. So you turn it back over to them and you let them begin to make their decisions and so forth, and you might get to free rein. But you know, if you're going to go to free rein with them, have a little conversation that says this: you know what, mom and dad are going to give this over to you and make it your responsibility, and we're expecting you to be responsible with it. Now, if you're not, then we might have to, you know, shift to a different model. Okay. Just understand that, you know, that you can have freedom and all the responsibilities that go with it. But if you abuse that freedom, there will be restraint. That's what our prison system is about. I mean, it ought to be about, right? It exercises a certain amount of restraint. It takes individuals who do not know how to conduct themselves well within society and cause problems and even hurt and kill other people. And it puts them in a place where they can't do that anymore. They're not allowed to do that. I'm not recommending prison to parents for their kids, but, you know, that's the kind of thing that sometimes you have to do. You have to do. It doesn't mean that the first time a person makes a mistake, you right away throw them, you know, under the bus, or, you know, sometimes you have to walk with people and help them learn from their mistakes and grow through their mistakes. It takes maturity and seasoned wisdom and the mind of Christ for us to really say, what is the best approach in this situation? What are the results I'm looking for, and what's the best way to get there? To be directive, consultative, or free rein? And how does the mind of Christ posture me so that I am pausing, right? I'm identifying and I'm adjusting, because I'm really interested in you. The outcome is for your best, not for me, but for your best. And that's what love calls us to do. And Christ is our example. Father, thank you for the privilege we've had to be able to look at these things. I pray that you'll continue to shape us by affording us opportunities to make these applications, have these conversations with one another, so that we can be effective in all the context of interpersonal relationships and mission that you call us to fulfill. Through Christ, we ask these things humbly. Amen.